Hello, this is Richard Bennett with High Tech Forum podcast series, and I'm with Fred Baker in Boulder, Colorado, where we just finished up a meeting of BitTag, and Fred's going to join us on our second podcast. So, hi, Fred.
Hello.
For people who don't know, Fred is a Cisco fellow, which is it's a pretty fancy job at Cisco. He's been at Cisco for, what, about 20 years?
20 years.
Before Cisco, he worked for Control Data, Vitalink, and ACC. And Fred's the editor or co-author of 54 different internet RFCs covering topics like traffic management, security, graynets, IPv6. He's worked on a vast array of tech policy issues, including CALIA, SOPA, net neutrality, the IPv6 transition. He often meets with people in law enforcement to help them understand what's doable, what's not doable within the internet infrastructure, what the implications are, some of the things that they'd like to do. And so today we're going to, I think, pretty much touch on the main issues that Fred's currently interested in, which is a lot of stuff. So, Fred, why don't you tell us just, when I talked to Dave Farber in the first podcast, and I think it was kind of fascinating when we began that discussion with how he got interested in computers. So how did you come to be interested in networking and computers? And
well, computers started out when I was in high school. The local NASA installation, which was Lewis Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio, which has changed its name since then, but right by Cleveland Hopkins Airport, had an Explorer post that dealt with electronics. And so we got to play with some fancy computers, an IBM 360-67, which was at the time a really big and fancy machine. And I got to do some interesting things. And so I went to school and worked toward a degree in computer science, which I never finished. Mm. I still don't. Someday I need to get my bachelor's.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1973, when I left school, you actually couldn't get a job in computer science. Control Data that year took an across-the-board 10% pay cut. And there were just no jobs. Mm-hmm. And so, fine, I worked in a furniture factory, I worked in a glue factory, I lived in a Christian commune and was a deacon in the commune for a couple of years. And then 1978, I wanted to get married, and that required a job that paid actual money.
yeah, that worked.
So I, started looking around in the newspaper and found a job with Control Data Communication Systems Division, which was doing front-end computers for large mainframes. And worked for 6 or 7 years for Control Data doing that. And then left them to go work for Vitalink, which was doing an early, I guess today we would call it an Ethernet switch. We called it a bridge at the time. But it was working out the algorithms along with some people at Digital for Ethernet switching. And I wound up with customers coming back to me and saying, okay, I've got your long-haul Ethernet switching in place, and that's good, except that this application isn't working the way I'd like, or there's some issue in the network. And so we would wind up looking at, okay, do I need to prioritize traffic in order to make interactive traffic work better?
Well, so you basically started working with Vitalink when Ethernet was still not really even completely defined at the way it is now. This sounds like this is like coax Ethernet.
This is late 1983. At the particular time, you couldn't buy an Ethernet chip. An Ethernet controller was a board. Uh-huh. A few years later, we were using Lance chips and other chips. But at that particular point, you couldn't buy a chip for an Ethernet. And this whole idea of using a really high-speed line, like 56 kilobit, was just, this was a new idea.
For the listeners, when ARPANET was first brought online, the high-speed backhaul links were 56 kilobits per second, which is what you get out of a dial-up modem today.
Yeah, And so we moved on from there, of course, to T1 and T3, and you know, whatever else, you know, that we've done since. But so I very quickly got involved with this concept of quality of service, which 10 years later became the differentiated services architecture, which I'm certainly not the only person that worked on, but I made a number of contributions.
Well, I mean, I think one of the interesting things here is that you're, despite the fact that you didn't have a PhD in computer science when you started working with networking, it's probably fair to say that your skills developed as the technology itself developed. And so
yes.
In the early 80s, networking technology was actually pretty simple compared to what it is today. And there were, I'm sure you're aware, there's sort of a big controversy in that era about whether the token ring style network or the Ethernet was the better architecture. And as Dave Farber said, you know, what we ended up with was sort of a hybrid of the two in some respects, because we have an Ethernet that can do quality of service, which is something that token ring really excelled at, but it's also faster and more resilient than token ring was. So,
and a lot cheaper, which was a driving factor.
Yeah, tons cheaper, yeah. Because we have mass market chips, and we have what? Ethernet now goes up to 400 gigabits per second?
Yes. And we're working on the next step.
Yeah. Which will be what? Terabit?
Probably terabit.
Yeah, terabit. That's a lot of bits. And so quality of service is nonetheless important. Quality of service is the thing, also for the listeners, that enables you to mix different applications on the same network. So historically, when we had an application that we wanted to support with a communications network, we designed a network around the application. That's how we got the telegraph network. That's how we got a telephone network. That's how we got cable TV. Each one of those was designed for that one, kind of one and only application. And one of the insights that the internet brought to the world of networking is, hey, folks, you could actually design one network that's capable of doing more than one thing. If, you know, you define a service for it that's sufficiently general, we could have one network that with convergence could support all three of these legacy applications, and also the needs of data apps, where people need to sit down at terminals and access remote computers, and sit down at computers and access remote databases, and mix that with a network that handles voice and video streaming, and I guess nobody really sends telegrams anymore, but we have something very much like that called email.
Or Twitter.
Twitter pretty much is 21st century telegram. But quality of service comes into play because despite the reason that these networks were designed for applications in the past is because these applications have subtle differences in the kind of service they require from the network. So when you're a voice telephone call has different requirements in terms of latency and volume than, say, a video streaming session. So if we have a network that has a mechanism that can adapt to the needs of the different applications, then we all win, right?
That's pretty much it. Now another part of that is the interactions of things. If I build a purpose-dedicated network, then I only have to think about that application. If I build a generalized network and multiplex applications over it, then I also have to ask about the interactions between applications. And frankly, the first problem that got me into quality of service considerations at all, I had a customer in Dallas who had a quite large network surrounding Dallas and was using what in 1987 was a high-speed line. He had 128 kilobit lines between different buildings within his network, and most of his use of that local area network, that Ethernet, extended Ethernet, was terminal servers, which are sending very short messages, and yes, I got it, and Echoplex and all that kind of thing. And he got this new kind of computer to him. It was called Unix, something like that. And it did file transfers.
Some primitive form of Linux, I think that was.
Primitive form of Linux, yes. And so now all of a sudden you'd get somebody that wanted to take, you know, a few megabytes or a really large file at 128 kilobits and move it somewhere, and all the terminal servers would hiccup. And so he came back to me, and literally I'm sitting at my desk, I get a phone call from the customer, and so what do I do about this? And so okay, we put in a technology that allowed him to prioritize the interactive traffic, the terminal server traffic, over file transfer. And it actually worked on a very primitive basis. It said, gee, file transfers are usually big messages and terminal server messages are short. Let's prioritize the short ones.
And when was this?
This is 1987.
Yeah, it's interesting because it mirrors an engineering choice that was actually made on NSFNet in the early 80s.
Well, NSFNet started in 1986. And so it was actually one of several parallel networks that were done under NSF funding. I was the principal engineer back at the plant for another one called USAN. It was done in the same program and testing things out. So their prioritization of traffic, that would be more like 1989, 1990.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay, because, I mean, that's when they started.
Yeah.
But what they were dealing with was the fact of congestive collapse on the 56 kilobit network.
Well, I'm thinking about the fact that it may actually go back to the ARPANET days where the Telnet sessions had higher priority than FTP did.
Yeah,
because Telnet is an interactive terminal emulator. Mm-hmm. So,
and the thing was the congestive collapse on the 56 kilobit NSFNet and the ARPANET. They were dealing with the fact that, you know, OMG, bad things are happening out here. Let's at least get this through. And of course, we were also doing experiments saying, well, what if we routed the FTP or the file transfers? Anything that you would set the delay tolerant flag in an IP packet on, then we'll route that over a satellite link that has higher bandwidth. And therefore the lower delay, the terrestrial line, would get the low delay and high bandwidth could go via delay.
Well, and this is something that comes about because the way that people use interactive terminals is like you would type. You type on your keyboard, and in some implementations, you actually, the character didn't get echoed until it got to, it didn't show up on your screen until it went to the remote terminal and then came back.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that sort of quickly got pushed aside to where you had something called local echo, so your keystrokes would show up on your screen because of local action, and when you hit the return key,
it would send the whole line.
But that required re-engineering device drivers in some applications because it was just a form of interaction that no matter how good your networking was, the delay wasn't really tolerable.
So when I moved on to ACC, you know, fair queuing was a new idea. Mm-hmm. I read it and did one of the first commercial implementations. I read it in SIGCOM 1989. I never patented what I did because I'd read it in a book. Uh-huh. And that got my company upset later because they really wanted to have a patent on it.
Yeah. Well, but somebody who could have found the book is prior art, you know.
Right, right.
Would have cost
a
lot of money.
Well, and that came up later. But okay. Yeah. So, I mean, so when we got into the differentiated services architecture, of course, by then, 155 megabit, 622 megabit were common speeds. And we weren't so much looking at the particular delay characteristics of voice. That was an issue. Deploying voice on IP, the jitter effect of the network became an issue, and we wind up putting voice into a priority queue for that reason. But then,
and jitter for the listeners, jitter is variations in delay. So, typically in a voice over the internet application, You don't send a lot of data, but you send the data in small packets that are quite frequent, and you want the intervals between those packets are ideally, you know, pretty consistent. But the internet being a statistical network, that rarely happens in practice.
Right.
And it's not something that you can actually force to happen by simply increasing the capacity, because it has to do with the other sources, with the interactions between your voice application and the other users.
The fact is that applications grow to fill the available capacity. So this question of why don't I just solve it with bandwidth has been a running gun battle for the entire duration of the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could just get more bandwidth in there, then I wouldn't have this problem. Don't make me play with the priority of traffic. You know, I'll just add more bandwidth. And hey, you know, if you can solve it using adding more bandwidth, by all means, it's simpler and easier and gets you out of a whole lot of questions. But the thing is that so for example, relatively recently, in the last 10 years, we've had Nutella and BitTorrent and this, that, and the other that are moving large numbers of files around. Mm-hmm. And often moving chunks of them at the same time. And basically, okay, how can I maximize my use of the bandwidth? I'll open up as many.
Well, that's sort of the whole point of peer-to-peer file sharing, is that when you're downloading a large file, and these are large, they're gigabit, mm-hmm. gigabit files and larger, you want to use all the resources you can get access to make that transaction complete, the file transfer transaction complete, mm-hmm. as quickly as possible.
Right. But so mm-hmm. now in the net neutrality discussion, one of the discussions between the FCC and industry has been with Comcast. And I'm sticking words in their mouth, and what I'm giving you now is not a Comcast statement. But fundamentally, they had a certain amount of bandwidth, and they're, you know, they're not stingy. They're putting in enough bandwidth to do the job, and they find that their subscribers start doing things that make them unable to provide consistent service to their other subscribers, mm-hmm. and so they started pushing back on BitTorrent. Mm-hmm. You know, can we please just block this application?
Yeah, and I think we've both heard various people from Comcast say that one of the specific issues they had when the BitTorrent issue arose was they had just started offering a voice service. But they had a lot of customers who were using Vonage, using a voice over IP service for their telephone service. And when other customers started using BitTorrent, it was actually the first application to grab substantial amounts of upstream upload bandwidth, because most, you know, the typical pattern in networks is you download more than you upload if you're the end user, if you're the human, you know, the set of eyeballs. And so the first casualty of BitTorrent was Vonage. And mm-hmm. so they had Vonage customers that were calling in and saying, okay, I see what you're doing. You're degrading my Vonage service because now you're selling this voice thing and you want me to buy that instead. And then the accusations that came on the public policy side about the BitTorrent, what they were doing with BitTorrent, was people who said, oh, okay, we see what you're doing to BitTorrent. You sell a video service, and so you're degrading this alternative revolutionary video service in order to make more money on cable TV.
The real problem there was just there was so much traffic. And, I mean, there's a lot of bandwidth, but there's so much traffic that something had to give. Mm-hmm. And now what they've come up with since then is a way of running round robin on a cable network so that the top talkers, we're not dropping traffic, we're not disadvantaging them in any way, but we ensure that everybody else gets to talk too.
Yeah. So they also, in fairness to the critics of Comcast, even Comcast has admitted that the practices they were using to try to limit the bandwidth that BitTorrent could take were not really appropriate. They were
what they thought they could do at the time.
Yeah.
And so then they came back to their vendors, mm-hmm. my company being one of them, Aris being another one, mm-hmm. and said, "Could we do something different?" And came up with a better approach.
So you helped them to come to the fair share. Well, actually, I think Cisco is credited with being among the principal designers of the hybrid fiber coax system.
It is. And that's now not specifically me. That's our guys that do that. Uh-huh. But yeah, Cisco is certainly involved.
With the idea that of bringing fiber into a neighborhood, hooking it up to a neighborhood head end, and then using the coaxial cable to do packet switching and it has some lovely quality of service protocols, mm-hmm. you know, designed into it that are currently not.
So you know, just with that, I got involved with traffic differentiation, mm-hmm. and by extension, net neutrality. You know.
So did you work on the DiffServ standards in IETF?
Oh, yeah. DiffServ is defined in total by, I think, 54 RFCs, mm-hmm. and I'm an author on 11 of them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and the people that I tend to identify with that work, with at least initially, David Clark was
involved, and
Carpenter.
Kathy Nichols, Brian Carpenter, mm-hmm. Brian and Kathy chaired the DiffServ working group.
Uh-huh.
Dave Clark was kind of
the chief architect, I think, of the internet for almost 10 years.
But in this particular context, he was driving what was called the integrated services architecture.
Oh, okay.
Which is where RSVP.
And that was a precursor to DiffServ.
Right, right. And, you know, we got the integrated services architecture out there, and basically nobody deployed it. And we said, okay, so we do want to enable companies, ISPs, enterprise, mm-hmm. to be able to do the things they need to do.
Yeah, as initially designed, the internet's integrated services architecture was difficult to implement because it had to be supported in every single router in a chain to be fully effective.
That's right. Actually not true, but it had to be supported by the routers that would need to be reserving bandwidth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But okay. So I worked on InServ, and then when we started the DiffServ project, fine. I worked on that.
And so DiffServ is more doesn't provide you the same degree of guarantee that a reservation protocol like integrated services
So integrated services, what we did was we said, you know, you want to have some number of bits per second between here and there,
mm-hmm.
and fine, we will ensure that the routers that are going to be controlling that,
mm-hmm.
will give you that bandwidth if you supply the traffic. Now, that doesn't mean, if you think in terms of a traditional telco channel bank, that would mean, fine, you get this 64 kilobits and not somebody else's 64 kilobits, you get exactly 64 kilobits. And DiffServ actually doesn't say, or InServ didn't say, you get exactly 64 kilobits. But if you give me 64 kilobits of load, then you'll get that 64 kilobits. If you give me less load, the bandwidth that you asked for will actually be used by somebody else.
Okay, it'll be distributed to other applications.
And if you try to use more than that, it's not like I'm going to throw your traffic away.
But if it's available, you'll get it. Yeah.
If I've got capacity to do it, you'll get that through, yeah. too.
Well, and integrated services is used in LTE networks.
It
today.
Is.
I mean, under IMS, when you do mobile data, you're using InServ. And when you do, certainly when you do HD voice over LTE, you're going to be heavily dependent on InServ. So, I mean, I think it was maybe
ahead of its time.
Well, it required a retrofit into an infrastructure that seemed to be working pretty well for what it was required to do, which was mainly file transfer or terminal
elastic traffic
at the time.
Yeah.
And so we didn't really have the need for it. I mean, it was designed in advance of the need, which is, I think, not that well understood, because a lot of people say, well, it was a failure because it was, you know, not implementable and it was too complex. And I said, no, we just didn't have the applications that required
right.
that service.
And, of course, we've got the same issue with IPv6 right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we finished the IPv6 specification in 1998. We've had trial deployments in various places. That's just picking up now. And why? We haven't needed it until now.
Well, and the data that I've seen on IPv6 says that there's not a great need for it in the United States because we have more than our fair share of IPv4 addresses. But in China, you pretty much, if you're on the internet, you're using IPv6.
That's not quite true. Okay, and if we were on video, I would start showing you websites.
Oh.
Turns out that So Google has public measurements of the traffic coming to it. And in China, coming to it is a very nominal level, like 0.5% of the traffic coming to it is IPv6. In the United States, they're saying today 17% of the traffic coming to them is using IPv6. And specifically coming from Verizon Wireless, it's about 2/3 of the traffic. Okay. And in different countries, it's different. In Belgium right now, Google is saying that 30% of the traffic coming to them is using IPv6. And a simple quadratic projection says that this time next year, one could imagine 70% of the traffic.
Well, that's a heck of a lot more volume than conventional wisdom says that it's
conventional,
like,
wisdom isn't very well educated.
So that's
actually been changing very dramatically over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I did. I should say, it's a couple of days ago, I was using Wireshark to examine some network speed test data, which is network. Wireshark's a tool that lets you look at packets. And I was quite astonished at how many IPv6 addresses I saw in the capture of just sort of the packets going in and out of the network in my office. I was focused on another issue at the time, but I think that's actually pretty significant. So IPv6 is actually finally taking off, and
it is.
And one of the benefits that I've heard you tout of IPv6 is that it's difficult to actually have bidirectional services on IPv4 networks that are behind network address translators. The home router, essentially, when most people connect to the internet from their home, they're behind a home router that actually shares a single IP address with all the devices in the home. And when you have this scenario that we're going to get to just in a few years, where we have dozens of devices in the home that need to have occasional access to the Internet of Things, it's going to be absolutely necessary for each of those devices to have a unique address because of the way the Internet architecture is structured to make full benefit.
Yeah. So we've actually, in the standards arena and in various arenas, for a number of years, looked at network address translators and firewalls as a problem. Mm-hmm. And the reason being that they act like a diode. You can open a session one way, but not the other.
Right. So you can contact anything you want on the internet as long as you initiate it from your laptop or your smartphone. But if the device on the other end wants to actually contact you because it has some important information to tell you, and you don't have an active session with them, unless your firewall is very carefully set up in terms of the mapping of the ports to the end user devices inside the home network, can't really deliver that packet, so it falls on the
floor. An example of that kind of an issue is at my daughter's house. Now, she's had a couple of break-ins over the last few years, and so her husband and I went around and put a surveillance system around the house, and camera recording onto a disk somewhere. And one of the really nice things, one of the things that made her want that particular system, was the fact that she could, from her Apple phone or from her laptop, wherever she happened to be able to access that video and look at the surveillance around her house. Mm-hmm. And the thing was that it required a hole to be punched in the firewall to allow the thing to go through.
Yeah.
Well, what we didn't realize at the time we set that up was that she had a router, I don't know if Linksys, D-Link, something, router in her home. And in addition, there was a network address translation that was happening within her cable modem.
Oh.
And you couldn't put a hole punch into the cable modem.
Mm.
With net result, she bought this system to have surveillance on her house and to be able to look at the status of her house at any time. And she can't do that because of the network address translator there. Okay, it's a service that she bought, that she wanted, that she can't have. And now, give you another example, take a look at Skype. What Skype does is that from your laptop, you open a session with somebody out in the great wide internet and maintain that session as long as you have the Skype application running. And then when it wants to, or you decide you want to connect to somebody else, or somebody decides they want to connect to you, what they wind up doing is they connect to this server out in the middle of nowhere, and so it now then hijacks, if you will, its own session into your laptop,
mm-hmm.
and trades that session in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in order, and that is what is actually used. So you actually have a Skype session running and traffic going through your firewall the entire time that the Skype application is up, not just when you're placing a call.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we wanted to do with SIP...
This is why Skype makes it very difficult to turn it off. I mean, if you want to stop Skype running on your laptop, it's kind of tricky to do that.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You can do it, but it's
right.
Not straightforward.
So what we wanted to do with SIP was enable a person to place a call from the outside in.
Yeah, SIP is the session initiation protocol. It's the internet standard for doing things like what Skype does.
Yeah, and so it's used in IMS and you know, a variety of telephone networks. So we actually started working on a protocol that we called RSIP,
mm-hmm.
Which we would put a proxy in effect into the NAT firewall,
mm-hmm.
so that somebody coming in could talk to that and it would talk to the
Skype app on your laptop.
Well, yeah. The SIP app on your laptop,
yeah.
and allow somebody to place a call coming in. We never mm-hmm. completed that because basically we decided it was too complex. It just wasn't going to work. Okay. But so what Skype has done is what they had to in terms of mm-hmm. Running this thing full time, just in order to be able to use it for the few minutes in the day that you actually want to run a Skype call.
Yeah, I think probably general users, what they identify Skype with, well, it's cheap, it's free. The audio quality is really good when it's working well. But the actual engineering magic of Skype is the firewall traversal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because they've solved that problem and saw mm-hmm. and there's about 12 different solutions you have to be a fully general firewall traversal solution.
And so now with IPv6, if I can make network address translation not necessary,
mm-hmm.
Fine. Have a firewall. You want to apply a policy and not allow this, but mm-hmm. you know, whatever else you want to do, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not require translation.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I can make all that happen using basic IP.
Yeah.
I can make firewall traversal happen as long as the policy allows it.
Yeah.
And I can make the policy flexible enough to allow this and not allow that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to have all the hijinks that Skype has been forced to do.
So it'll actually considerably simplify the structure of the the application programming that people have to do to use the internet, the understanding of really very obscure details inside the internet mm-hmm. protocols about how network address translators work and what they do and what they don't do. You don't have to understand that. You can focus on your application when the transport is so mm-hmm. simplified.
And simplification winds up... That improves reliability, availability, maintainability, security.
Yeah, I'm thinking the security is the big win because, I mean, it's really hard to create meaningful security policy in a home router when you can't understand what it's doing. The average person can't understand what it's doing. But when you have this very simple, straightforward mapping of one address to one device, and then you have a port for each different services, that's a structure that really an elementary school child can understand. You can have security policies that you can articulate that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you can change and move on if you need to. That's great. So IPv6 is finally catching on. That's good news.
And not as much as I'd like, but okay, in time.
But is IPv6 and the proliferation of addresses, is that going to have an impact on internet routing?
It'll improve internet routing quite a bit. So right now we have roughly a little bit over 500,000 prefixes floating around in the backbone in IPv4. And
these prefixes are essentially, they stand for networks.
Yeah.
So they're the units that traffic is routed mm-hmm. on.
So what that means, there's about 60,000 autonomous systems. So an ISP would be an autonomous system somewhere in the backbone today. Mm-hmm. And you know what I just told you was that the average autonomous system has 8 or 9 prefixes floating mm-hmm. around in the backbone, and some of them have really quite a few more, and are doing things like trying to engineer traffic flows using them or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this is making the routing tables really large. Now, routing table being large in and of itself isn't a problem. We have the capacity to deal with that. All but right. It has a cost implication. I have to be able to store it. Uh-huh. I have to be able to communicate it between ISPs.
And the thing that makes routing tables grow is that you don't have an entry in the routing table for every device. You only have an entry in it for every network. And so with IPv6, you can have all these devices. You can have I can have my 200 devices in my home, but I still only have one network prefix that stands for my entire mm-hmm. home, and that's what.
And if you're getting your prefix from your supplier, from your upstream network, which is typically what you do, mm-hmm. that upstream network might have only one prefix in the backbone, mm-hmm. or might divide it into two for engineering reasons.
Oh, okay.
Today they might have 10 or 20 or 100.
And they'll have all these different prefixes because of the way they're actually kind of overloading, to use a technical term, the prefix to do some routing, to do some optimization.
Well, sometimes that. Okay, yeah. That's what we call BGP traffic engineering. Mm-hmm. But also, frankly, if they're going to their regional internet registry and getting a prefix, and the regional internet registry will only give them 1,000 addresses at a time. Well, that's the prefix they've got.
Oh, okay. So they have multiple prefixes because they...
In part because they go to the RIR and say, I need another one, and this is what he's got.
Yeah. So with IPv6, it's probably going to be more like when you get a MAC address from IEEE 802 dispenses MAC addresses for Ethernet, you get a 48-bit address and some number, I forget how many bits, I think maybe half of that is a vendor identifier and the rest is stuff you can use. So you get you get millions of device addresses at a time. And so there are some vendors of Ethernet chips that are Ethernet interfaces that have multiple
vendor IDs. Yeah. Yes. But okay, but okay. So rare. Now what would typically happen with that is fine. You've got whatever devices you have on your Ethernet in the IP layer. We're going to put one subnet on that and we'll now advertise that subnet. And typically in IPv4 networks, a subnet might be 256 addresses or 128 mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. In an IPv6 network, we've got 2^64 power addresses in there. You know, how many you want, you know, do you need to be able, in the smart grid, for example, do you need to go to a neighborhood and read all the meters? Well, that might be 15,000 meters in a single subnet. Mm-hmm. With IPv4, there's no way. With IPv6, sure, fine. Trivial if that's problem. The right thing to do, yeah, do yeah. it.
Yeah, they just put a smart meter on my house a couple of days ago.
Probably
has an IPv6 address.
Maybe. Possibly. Okay, so and then now when you get an allocation for a company, we would give you an allocation for 2^16, so 65,536 local area networks, mm-hmm. Ethernets in your company, and each of which has all of those addresses. And then you would get that either as a provider independent address, you'd get that directly from the registry, or you would get it from your ISP. Now, mm-hmm. now what we give the ISP is at least 64,000 customers worth of mm-hmm. address space, and quite often up to 8 times that much. Mm. So what we call a /29, /32, and a /29, which...
That's how many bits are in the address.
Right, and so we can now very reasonably have one prefix per autonomous system, yeah. or a couple of them for engineering purposes.
Well, that's great because it reduces the stress. One of the limiting factors in the growth of the internet that people identified, IETF put out an RFC on this issue about what maybe 10 years back about the growth of routing tables. What routing tables were growing faster than the capacity of the content addressable memories that are used in routers to do the next hop lookups. Mm-hmm. So there were, and the content addressable memories are not really beneficiaries of Moore's Law because they're not mass market commodity parts, and Moore's Law depends on investments by semiconductor manufacturers, which can be justified in the case of mass market products, but a more specialized thing like a CAM, they don't really get those benefits. So this, when you slow down the growth of routes, you actually kind of future-proof routers.
Well, and you make it possible, frankly, for us to deliver a smaller CAM and still meet the requirement.
Yeah.
And that translates to power. Uh-huh. And these are very power-hungry devices.
Yeah.
It translates to heat.
Mm-hmm.
And it translates to the cost of the router.
Yeah. And probably reliability, too. If it's high power and high heat, they probably don't have the same lifespan as conventional DRAMs. So that's great. I was kind of disappointed in IPv6 because for a long time I've wanted a completely new architecture for the internet. I still do. I think eventually we'll have to have something like John Day's architecture that's a little bit more friendly to security. But it doesn't look like I'm going to get my wish anytime soon.
Well, I hear you. And by the way, let me say that John Day isn't wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's a little bit late.
Mm-hmm.
Commercially, what's happening is happening.
And we're on a wave, and we can't stop the wave. So we just
can't really stop the wave. Yeah. But I won't say that John Day's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say that either. I mean, I think he's brilliant. It's just that he kept these ideas to himself for quite a while.
Well, he derived them from Salzer, and, you know, there are others.
Yeah.
Dave Clark was actually involved in them. But
I should do a podcast with John pretty soon, too.
Yeah,
I've actually written a lot of stuff on High Tech Forum, and John's written guest posts.
Yeah.
And his book, Patterns of Network Architecture, I think is something that everybody needs to read who's concerned about the future of networking, because it's a really clear account of the past.
Right.
And it's hard to actually get good information about the development of the internet because histories tend to be written by the victors.
Yeah.
And they tend to emphasize they paint a more positive picture, I think, than would necessarily be the mm-hmm. objective view of future historians if they can dig stuff out. Okay, so security, that brings us to issues like CALIA and SOPA that you've been very active in.
Right.
CALIA is the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's your take on CALIA? Is it you? Because I know you were one of the people that shaped that.
Well, actually, I wasn't one of the people that
changed
that.
Well, at least responded to the...
We
helped the law enforcement understand.
We've certainly done things with law enforcement related to it. So CALIA is divided into two important parts, Title I, Title II. And the Title II carriers are telephone carriers, very recently now broadband carriers, if the courts support it. And information services, Title I, have been the Internet and CompuServe and Telenet, things like that. And the privacy community, people like GNU and CDT, spend a lot of time with Congress in making sure that there was a clear distinction between information services and telecom services. Now, that was unfortunate in a certain respect, and that is that it forced the question to be about the wrong thing.
Mm.
Okay? And by the way, I'm a friend of privacy. I'm all for privacy, but the way it got phrased was wrong. Okay, with the telephone system, the primary content being communicated is voice. And so the thing got written as being about voice. And by the way, the business models of the telecoms.
Well, and about voice. The law enforcement interception of voice, it's a different animal than say getting someone to take down a pirated movie because voice
so,
doesn't.
So that's not the question I'm going after here. The thing is that criminals are not as dumb as we tend to believe that they are. There are criminals that can build submarines to deliver drugs to the United States.
And, evil geniuses.
Okay.
Bond villains.
And I mean, a lot of your spam comes from evil geniuses in random countries. And the thing is that for the FBI to do its job, it needs to be able to intercept the communications of somebody that's communicating. Okay. And the 1968 law, OCCPM, actually gave them that capability and didn't give them any power to coerce it. But it gave them, you know, if they're communicating with postal mail, you can open postal mail. The thing is that they need that capability. But CALEA.
But it's constrained. You have to get a court order, and there's some due process that.
There is, and there should be. There should be. But CALEA makes it all about voice. So now, as it expanded into the internet, we got voice on IP. All of a sudden, we in the technical community were being asked, okay, can you please identify the voice so that we can intercept the voice? And it's like, well, no, this is actually an IP network.
These are all bits.
If the guy's communicating using IM, why do you care which is voice? Voice is actually a very small stream. You know, what you want to be able to do is identify the communications of the surveillance subject and intercept those communications.
Yeah, it shouldn't matter whether he's sending a tweet or an email or an IM
or whatever else.
Oh, yeah.
And so CALEA actually breaks down pretty badly in that regard. Oh. And this is something that the FCC has had to deal with. Mm-hmm. And finally, at least in part, this change to make the broadband operators be Title II carriers means that they have to implement law enforcement capabilities.
Oh, so this is one of those implications of being classified under Title II, and they...
Yep.
They're, was there any forbearance around this question?
So there was a removal of forbearance over the preceding years. So starting 2002 or something like that, FCC kind of said, well, the intercept capabilities of a Title II carrier are also required of a broadband carrier.
Oh.
Okay. So in the open internet order, they didn't even talk about that. They'd already dealt with that question. Okay. But yeah, so they have to go get a warrant. They have to do whatever. Now, I got involved in CALEA, in lawful intercept, and I have an RFC on the topic. Basically, I was avoiding being involved in it like the plague. I really didn't want to be involved with it until I got to talking with the editor of an Etsy document on the topic who said, I've got a really great solution for lawful intercept. It's cheap, it's secure, the right thing happens, it's great. Just do this. And he said, fine, I'm going to split every fiber, and he lives in a very small country, I'm going to split every fiber in my small country and take one end and run it under the intelligence services door. They take what they want, and I don't have to know. And, you know, this is great, this is wonderful, and I cringed. Oh, my goodness. You know, I was thinking about...
We were doing that in the U.S. for a while, weren't we?
So the rumor is.
Yeah.
Turns out that once you make a capability, anybody that can get their hands on it has access to it. So the Greek prime minister in 2002 found that he had 100 of his ministers that all had their phones tapped, and nobody could say how the phones got tapped or where the data was going.
Mm-hmm.
And Vodafone literally didn't know. In the mid-1990s, there were two cases with the LAPD, one in which there was a detective that put an unauthorized tap on a payphone and was feeding information to other detectives relating to investigations they had going on, which wound up in tainting those court cases and having convicted criminals walking free. And then later in the decade, there was another guy where the mafia or organized crime, actually leaned on a police officer that was involved in the intercept. And so now you had organized crime watching the police. Well, and it's like, and, well, if it's just, I'm going to split all the fiber and run one end under their door, who's at the other end?
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So the big contribution that we made, besides here's an architecture and here's how you might do it, was to make sure that there's an audit trail. Let's make sure that there is a warrant. Let's make, hello, how does this work? Mm-hmm. To me, that's just really important. You need mm-hmm. to have that ability to watch the watcher.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I think this is something the general public has been aware of since Snowden. I mean, NSA had at least partially lawful program going on to monitor communications, but that the NSA, like any other organization, is made up of people, and people each have their own agenda and their vulnerabilities when you're just dumping this fire hose of essentially all the information that traverses the internet into one place, it's going to leak out.
And frankly, my problem with the NSA's activities is not that they're off catching the bad guys. Okay, I want them to catch the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's that they don't have the checks and balances mm-hmm. and the protections that one expects to find in a free
society.
Well,
and when you have individual agents in the NSA that are using these tools to monitor their ex-girlfriends, then you know there's an issue.
Yeah. Okay. So mm-hmm. now you asked about SOPA, and of course there have been a list of different laws that go after that. My fundamental issue there is with who is tasked to do something. If Hollywood, if the filmmakers or whoever want to track their product and make sure that people are paying for it, I don't have a problem with them tracking their product. What I do have a problem with them is forcing through regulation somebody who is not involved in their product to suddenly be the gatekeeper to make sure that it goes in the right way. Especially in the last few years, encryption has become far more important. We're seeing HTTPS, we're seeing use of PGP, we're, various kinds of encryption technologies. So if the ISP can't see the traffic, they can't see the URL, mm-hmm. they can't see, how are they going to enforce that? There's a variety of places that goes. I wound up at one point having a conversation with the UN Commission for Al-Qaeda. And they asked, literally, could you please observe that this traffic is an Al-Qaeda video and just make it go away, stop the thing, make it go away. And it's like, well, how well have we done with pornography and recognizing the video and making it go away? I'm sorry, we actually can't do that.
Yeah.
YouTube, making us responsible to
YouTube
do that.
YouTube does a pretty good job of taking pornography down, but it's because...
But they do it on their server.
Yeah, yeah. And they, after it's been decrypted, so they know what it is. They also, I think they rely on their user community to flag
stuff.
And you obviously can't crowdsource national security.
Right.
At least not in a meaningful way. Well, that's... one of the things that I just learned from you in the last couple of days is that there's an activity going on in the Internet Engineering Task Force, which is the group of people that define the protocols and the standards for the operation of the internet, on something called end-to-end DiffServ. So we talked about DiffServ in the beginning. It's a mechanism that allows us to get quality of service so that mm-hmm. applications don't interact with each other in unwanted ways. And applications like voice and video conferencing that have specific needs are more likely to get their needs met on the general purpose converged infrastructure than they would have without it. For a long time, it's been conventional practice that when networks interconnect, they don't observe quality of service commitments that the individual network may have made to their customers. They connect with what's called best effort, which is that essentially every packet gets treated pretty much the same as any other packet at the interconnection point between the networks. And
So that's actually called default, not
right,
best effort.
Default.
Okay, and the reason I'm careful on that is best effort's a defined term.
Uh-huh.
What it refers to is that a packet can be duplicated, can be dropped, can be reordered in flight.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from a discussion that happened in the 70s with the X25 guys, who mm-hmm. thought that their network that didn't do that was much better. Between ISPs, they will often, what the differentiated services architecture does is we put a mark, we put a number in the IP header of a packet that says I'm expecting.
And this is actually in a place that was reserved in the original design of IPv4 for that purpose,
yeah. So this is not a new thing. You know, we're reinterpreting it a little bit from the way IPv4 originally did, but mm-hmm. the number's there. Okay, and so it says, you know, this is, it doesn't say this is Skype traffic, doesn't say this is file transfer, it doesn't really say that. What it does say is it expects from the network a certain kind of service. And dear network, please do what I like. And that is cleared out, zeroed, between networks, or the value is simply ignored. And so Deutsche Telekom has a proposal in the IETF for a subset of the DiffServ architecture, a small set of code points, that would be understood end-to-end across multiple ISPs. And the reason being, they specifically want to offer those kinds of services end-to-end for their customers, and they want to be able to specify that so their customers know what to mark things at both ends and how to interpret that, and that when it goes through other ISPs, if the other ISP is signed up for it, they can make that happen. Yeah. So this would give you some improved quality of service behavior end-to-end, not just within a network.
Mm-hmm. So if a customer starts a voice call on Deutsche Telekom's network and they connect to...
And they would actually start it on their own network. And the mm-hmm. packet would go from there to Deutsche Telekom.
Yeah. So within their office, they start a voice call, then they hand it off to their provider, Deutsche Telekom. Deutsche Telekom hands it off possibly to a transit provider like Level 3, and they bring it to the U.S. and they connect it to AT&T or Comcast or whoever, mm-hmm. who delivers it to your home, and then in your home, mm-hmm. you know, it goes to your device. If every single one of these networks was actually implementing the differentiated services treatment that the customer, the original originating customer, had requested for that packet, you'd have a better quality call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the benefit to the ISP, frankly, is that he can now say, I deliver better end-to-end service.
Yeah. Yeah, your calls are clearer.
Yeah.
And in Europe in particular, high-definition voice has actually become quite prevalent from what mm-hmm. I understand. I mean, it's just starting to take off in the U.S. Some of the mobile operators will implement, Verizon, I think, pretty much implements widely within their network. So when one Verizon customer calls another, if they both have HD-capable phones, like an iPhone 6 is fits that description, you get a high-definition call that's actually better quality than you get with a landline. Like, what? It's sort of an incredible notion, right? We've lowered our expectations for voice quality, yeah. But yeah. So it's catching on. So what does it take to implement that?
What it really takes is agreements between the ISPs mm-hmm. and the value of a standard. A standard is an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we all agree to it, then they
can
say,
kinda,
fine.
So it's kind of like the boilerplate to a contract. I mean, it's
yeah,
something
and,
that
and the contract can say, I agree to do that.
Yeah.
Without having to say what that is, uh-huh. just I agree to do that.
Yeah. So it simplifies the, there have been some studies that say that most of the interconnection agreements in the world are handshake deals. And the nature of those handshake deals is that today everything gets default treatment. So we're talking about changing these handshake deals. So it's like, okay, we agree to observe the four levels of treatment that.
Yeah. And those handshake deals, I mean, there's a fair amount of complexity that goes into them in terms of, and, you know, if the bandwidth gets used more than mumble percent, then somebody's on the hook to add more bandwidth and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can break down when there's a violation of those understandings. So some of them are, the lawyers get really involved.
Mm-hmm.
Some of, especially the historical ones, might have been two guys in a bar.
Well, and do you anticipate that there'll probably be like quotas that say that the traffic you deliver, we can't really give?
I would expect so.
We can't give expedited delivery to more than, say, 20% of the traffic.
And there would be, in RFC 3247, there would be support for that particular number. Mm-hmm.
And once you have these agreements in place and you have the terms defined for, I think you said it was going to be four levels, probably four.
Something like
four
that.
Code points. So there'll probably be one for a very low latency, like a voice service.
Yeah. And I mean, I would have to go look at it, tell you exactly what they are, but something along that line.
In Wi-Fi quality of service, there's one grade that they nominally call voice, another that's nominally video. Then there's the default treatment, which is, they call it best effort. And then there's background, which is kind of a scavenger class. That would be like your patch updates, and maybe it's a peer-to-peer file transfer. Maybe. So it's an application that if no one else is really active, then you can get all you want. It's not expensive, but you know, you don't have the best seat.
This doesn't run at peak hours.
Yeah. But then we'll have equipment that can actually find out, you know, whether things are getting the desired treatment, and if they're not getting them, we can diagnose the reasons why. And eventually all these procedures can become automated because we have a standard that's telling us what's expected.
So that's basically what they're looking for in this particular document.
So is there general support, I think, within IETF for
Well, and this is within a particular working group. Mm-hmm. I think people are willing to see it happen. Mm-hmm. I think there's the set of authors on the document are pushing much harder than everybody else is. Uh-huh. But I don't hear anybody saying, oh, no, don't do that.
Well, and what this really, I mean, the IETF doesn't have the power to force anyone to do this. You define a standard, it goes out into the world, and then people, it's like, you know, you raise a flag and see if anybody salutes, right?
Pretty much. Our specifications are what we call de facto. People implement them because they help their business.
Mm-hmm. And so we'll at least have a path forward. So when people say, well, it can't be done, it's impossible, we'll get to run the experiment and find out. Okay. Well, that's great. So it's sort of a 20-year circle, more or less, from beginning to work on DiffServe to actually getting to the point where we have something that can be widely adopted, implemented, and produce the kinds of results.
Yeah.
I know you've got a plane to catch. So as much as I'd like to keep you here for another hour or so picking your brain, I think in all politeness, I have to let you go. And thank you so much for agreeing to join us on the second High Tech Forum podcast. And readers, after you listen to this on High Tech Forum, visit our forum section. That's hightechforum.org forums. And you can comment on what you heard, what you didn't hear. Thank you so much.